you a fan of this podcast? Do you wish there was even more juicy content for you to sink your ears into? Well, there is. You can become a premium member of this podcast for $5.99 a month and get full access to an archive of over 50 bonus episodes. Additionally, we release a bonus episode every single month. That's a ton of extra content, including my personal interior design diaries, extra tips, my talking about trends, and so much more. Additionally, you'll be keeping us on the airwaves each and every week because your premium membership money goes directly back to making this podcast amazing. Check us out at affordableinteriordesign.com. Click on podcast to learn more and to become a premium member today.
Need a high-end designer or a lot of money to get a luxe look. Be your own interior designer.
This is Affordable Interior Design, the podcast.
Here's your host, Betsy Hellman.
Hello, everyone. It's wonderful to be back with you this week. I'm so excited. It's rainy outside. It's feeling like spring is on its way. And I just got back from career day at my son and daughter's middle school. So I left my little baby with a sitter for maybe the third time in her life to go to career day. And it was my second time going to career day. I went last year for the kids. And, you know, I got the slides and I'm going to tell them what it takes to be an interior designer and what you should be interested in and what you should excel at school and things like this. And then, you know, a question that I get all the time is what do you actually need to have in terms of a degree, et cetera? So I figure I just do a quick rundown for you guys of my presentation, just sharing a little bit about my thoughts so you guys can think it over. And, you know, the middle schoolers asked great questions. And I have a feeling that some of you may not even know the answers because a lot of times when people are writing me questions for the podcast or just asking me out in public things, I find that there's some misconceptions about the industry. So the first thing is like, what do I do all day? So I had a slide kind of letting them know what the daily tasks are. And guys, I feel like everybody should see a slide like this before they pick a job, because sometimes you pick a career based on the fact that I want to help people. So I want to be a teacher, or I want to make a difference to people and help them with their well-being. So I'm going to be a massage therapist, or I'm going to be a physical therapist, right? And then you get excited about the outcome, but you don't actually know what it means every day. You know, like my friend who's a massage therapist, her body gets so tangled up in knots and so stressed by kind of massaging other people who are tense. She really has to work out her muscles and she gets so tense and it's so energetically depleting that she has to spend a lot of money on massages and restorative treatments to kind of rebuild her own energies. And, you know, in terms of the medical field, all the red tape around insurance and joining a practice versus going out in concierge medicine. So there's all this sort of financial or logistical side to not only being a doctor, but also education. Certainly in the wave of COVID and post-pandemic, you know, there's been so many new requirements, restrictions, things like that, that make the profession of actually teaching students and helping people that much harder and that much more inaccessible due to these hurdles. So I think if people really knew the day-to-day tasks of a career before they dove in, they might choose differently. So for instance, most interior designers spend all day behind a desk. Maybe they're talking to clients once or twice a month in person, but for the most part, they're behind a desk drafting. They're in their office making selections. Certainly, there's quite a bit of shopping. So that's fun, being out of the office and meeting with vendors. checking out fabrics, ordering samples, but a lot of it is just in the office, grinding, preparing, invoicing, spreadsheets, etc. With my job, I saw at a large firm that there was a lot of that, and I didn't want to do that. I wanted to meet people, transform spaces quickly, see a lot of spaces, make a big impact, but with smaller projects that didn't take so long. So I really tailored my business to only the aspects of interior design and those daily tasks that I really love: meeting with people, online shopping, creating fun, visually compelling presentations, that kind of stuff. Of course, I spend a lot of time when I'm with clients, not only getting to know them, but taking measurements, creating floor plans. So you really have to like that technical aspect. You have to like intimately learning a room, where the outlets are, where the light switches are. Is there a scuff in the paint over here? Do we have a flickering light over there? So really getting to know intimately the space you're going to be working on is key. And then, of course, presenting to the client, getting everything ready. I have a big presentation coming up this weekend. I'm getting everything ready. I'm presenting the rooms in such a way that I think the presentation will be more compelling to the clients. Like, I'll start with a room that's less controversial, get them excited about that design. Then I'll move into something where maybe I took a few more risks. In the dining room, I'm going to use some wallpaper, and I want to kind of get that initial buy-in. Oh my gosh, I love the family room. Let's keep going. So that way they're already feeling confident and secure by the time I throw them a little bit of a wild card. So thinking strategically about that presentation. And then, of course, bringing the presentation to life with beautiful visuals and mood boards and a spreadsheet that's easy to use and shop with. So that's really my daily life. And of course, running a business, I have lots of tax stuff and people management stuff. And I spend a large amount of time on that each week. But that's not something most designers have to deal with. So creating the floor plans and mood boards is really key, and being excited to kind of go in your hidey hole and make that art, if you will. And you know, the exciting thing about this profession too is that I can truly work from anywhere. So I can either meet my clients virtually, and then I can really work from anywhere. But of course, it's more lucrative to meet them at their homes, to go to where they are. So when I'm meeting them at their homes, I'll have one meeting, but then that work of shopping, presenting, making spreadsheets, all of that can be done virtually. I could be on vacation. I could be in a park. I could be at home. As long as I have a quiet space with reliable Wi-Fi, you can really take this job on the road, which I just love. I also love the challenge of learning people quickly. So I think it's really key to be deeply interested in people in this profession, because I have to get to know their preferences really quickly. I have to get them to trust me, which means I have to be a little bit vulnerable, sharing the fact that sometimes I'm messy, sharing the fact that sometimes my dog has accidents on the floor, which limits how much I want to spend on a rug. Or, you know, I watch a lot of screens, and so I want to bet TV in the bedroom. That way they'll be more open to telling me that they too watch a lot of screens, and that's a priority for them also. So kind of building that really authentic relationship so that I can create a space that totally works for them and that even solves some of their problems, like clutter and chaos in the entryway, things like that. And then I love working within a budget, not only because I see that it helps people of all means, it makes interior design accessible to everyone, but also because it just makes you have to think outside the box and be more creative, and creates a boundary that you have to kind of work within, which helps the timeline to go faster than having the budget for anything in the whole world. So in terms of who should be drawn to this job, who should be thinking about being an interior designer, somebody who likes art. You like to stroll through a museum. You like to look at pretty colors. You like to go to furniture stores. You don't have to know how to draw. You don't have to know how to paint. None of that. Of course, it's a nice thing to fully immerse yourself in the world of art in order to be a designer, but it is certainly not a necessity. I myself had an extensive art background. I don't use any of that in terms of drawing, painting, those techniques. Then you want to be friendly, because as I mentioned before, you want to get clients on your side. You want them to know, like, and trust you, so they refer their friends. And you just want to have a great working relationship in this somewhat personal environment. And you want to have kind of an excited personality. When I'm presenting to my clients, if I don't wholeheartedly get behind the presentation and really sell it, they're not going to be into my ideas either. So if I say, you know, here's the presentation, I just sent it to you in an email, look it over, let me know what you think. I worked really hard on it. Versus, let me guide you through my presentation. I can't wait to show you what I found. There's some really exciting things and I want to show you some different options. So let's dig in. You know, that's a totally different experience and it's going to have a different outcome. And then you also have to be really practical. A lot of new designers or designers who are just curious about the profession love picking out the pretty stuff, love immersing themselves in art and fancy items and things like this, but they don't enjoy staying within that budget. They don't enjoy finding fabrics that are quite durable. They want that cream sofa because it's going to look best in the room, but they're not thinking of how it's going to work best for that family. So you really do need to be practical in order to be successful, in my opinion. And you got to love math. People are always so surprised that half my job is math. Spatial relationships, geometry in terms of determining what shapes things need to be in a space, how those shapes work together. If I'm in a room and I've used a lot of circles in terms of end tables and ottomans, then I want to bring in some rectangles in terms of a boxy sectional or a media console that has those right angles. So I'm constantly thinking, do I have enough curves? Do I have enough straight lines? Do I have enough light colors? Do I have enough dark colors? Constantly thinking about shapes, contrast, and of course, measurements. You've got to know English because I have to communicate really well. If I have errors in not only my speaking, but also in my emails, the clients are going to think I'm not very professional. And then I do need to have an interest in technology. You know, this day and age, you must know a floor planning software. Ideally, you know a mood board creation software to create those, you know, presentations that are amazing, and also a spreadsheet software so that you can project manage what comes first, what comes second, but also build that shopping list and stay within a budget. So these are really key components that you have to be open to learning, which we teach in my academy, or you have to already know in order to be a good interior designer. In terms of that career path, I mean, you need an interest in art, as I mentioned before, and you do need, you know, if you're a high schooler or middle schooler looking to go into interior design, I highly recommend going and getting either a four-year degree or a two-year degree, because I also think that's just a learning process in terms of personal development, right? But if you've already been to college, if you've already been to a two or four-year program in any field, you probably don't want to do that again. And you're not going to learn the skills that it takes to take clients. So you may learn about history of interior design, some principles and theory of interior design. But in terms of that practical application, oftentimes it's not actually taught. I got my practical education first by having an internship with a famous designer, and then by opening my own firm and making lots of errors and figuring out sort of my methodology and turning it into a clear program that I could follow each time with success. And that then became my training program for my company, for all the designers who came to me, and then ultimately the academy. So that was the long way around, right? But now I have this amazing program where I can teach anyone, and it's relatively quick. And it's really fun, if you can, to be an entrepreneur as a designer. Not everybody wants to be an entrepreneur. Some people just want the steady paycheck and they want to be immersed in the world, but not necessarily fully responsible for the designs they create. And I get that, because being an entrepreneur has a lot of different parts in terms of invoicing your clients, creating your business structure, thinking about what packages you'll offer versus working at a different firm where all of that is kind of given to you. But the joys of being an entrepreneur are that, you know, when I worked at that large firm for that famous designer from Queer Eye, I saw the aspects of the job that I liked. I loved the creativity. I loved going to furniture stores. I loved being creative and selecting things. But I really hated being behind a desk all day. I really hated that at a large firm, typically you're not going to make any creative choices for many, many years. The lead designer wants to do all that, and you will execute these things. I didn't like working on one project for 6 years and emailing with the same client multiple times a week. I liked meeting new people and having fresh projects rather than just focusing on one project for a long, long time. So that's why I highly recommend an internship or some kind of way to view the industry if you're not going to become an entrepreneur, if you're not going to do your own thing, because you need to understand exactly how much will be creative. If you're going to leave a current job, like say a teacher or a doctor or physical therapist, to become an interior designer, I want you to know with confidence that the way you spend your days was worth the pivot. Right. And so you'll want to understand what it means to work for somebody else versus what you'd be doing if you worked for yourself. So that's just a little overview of what I shared with the middle school students. But I hope that it also informed you because you're interested in interior design if you're listening. And so many people come to me and ask about my personal path or my personal recommendations. And this is what I feel. This is my view of the industry, and I've been in it for 2 decades. So I feel like it's coming from a place that's pretty informed. And now it's time for a quick commercial break. Do you love this podcast? Do you wish you could learn even more? Well, we have an online class bundle. Our online class bundle is comprised of 3 online classes: Beautifying Your Home for Less, Styling Your Home, and the Fundamentals of Feng Shui. Each one of those 3 classes is between 30 and 45 minutes long and chock filled with visuals and tips, things that will help you to style your own space or help out with other spaces. Additionally, with the pack of 3 classes, you get an autographed copy of my book, Affordable Interior Design. You get all of that for only $99. Once again, that's the 3 online classes as well as the book for only $99. You just go to affordableinteriordesign.com/classes. Once again, affordableinteriordesign.com/classes to buy your bundle today. And if one of those classes sounded intriguing, but maybe you already have my book or some of the other topics are not of interest, you can buy the classes individually at that site as well. Each class is $40. So head over to affordableinteriordesign.com/classes to get your bundle or your online class today. All right, let's go to our more traditional format. Let's reach in the mailbag and see what's come in. Guys, you're wondering to yourself, you're thinking, how can I submit a question to the mailbag? I'm working on some spring projects. I've done my cleaning and I'm ready to do some nesting. I have questions about furniture selection, paint, wallpaper, etc. All you have to do is head over to affordableinteriordesign.com/podcast. Once again, affordableinteriordesign.com/podcast. There you can submit a question to the show. You can write me and just tell me something. I'd love to hear your experiences on Career Day and sort of where they led you. I remember in high school, I went to Career Day. But it was different. You like shadowed somebody in the community that you thought you may want to follow in their footsteps. So I remember I shadowed a graphic designer slash artist, and he had this really cool airbrush studio. And so I was able to make a drawing and then airbrush it, which for me was kind of mind-blowing. I'd never used that medium before. And it didn't necessarily make me want to be him. But it was so cool to just glimpse the world and see that you could make a living with an artistic passion. And I hope that I shared that with the kids today. But more importantly than just making a living with an artistic passion, I always thought you kind of had to choose one path or the other. Like, I loved math and was pretty good at math, but I was like, I don't want to be like statistics, accounting, whatever. I loved art and just wanted to spend every day doing art. But then I was like, oh, well, I have to abandon the math part of my brain. So that's what's so exciting about interior design. If you do feel like you want to use both sides of your brain, if you have sort of these 2 talents that you're wanting to work with, it's the perfect marriage of the two. frankly, being an entrepreneur will always get you involved with numbers because you're invoicing, you're making spreadsheets, you're checking profit and loss and balance sheets. So if you're an entrepreneur, you'll always get the math, no matter what industry. But I just wanted to share that little slice as well. All right, back to that mailbag. These questions keep me focused, guys, and I appreciate them. So my first question comes from Renee, and she's writing all the way from Nashville. She writes, Betsy, when I moved into this 1980s era condo almost a year ago, I was struggling with the layout of the living room, and I still am. It's a living room, dining room, entry space. I have a TV that's too large and it dominates one wall, and I do not know how to design around it. Should I just get rid of it? To keep the space calmer, should I have fewer furniture pieces? I like mid-century modern design and I've inherited traditional pieces. Please give me some tips for making them work together. Okay, so Renee, thank you for the picture. It's very illuminating. There's a lot going on in here. And there's a lot of different styles. And yes, I see both the MCM, I see the traditional, and I think this room is suffering from a lack of two-word phrase. You know, we want that style word that's clear and we want the feeling word that's clear. And I'm not saying traditional furniture, which has ornate carvings, detailings, tends to be more of an older style, sometimes utilizes antiques, and mixing these clean lines, simple shapes from mid-century modern. I'm not saying they can never work together, but they need a really cohesive vision. So for instance, you know, you might want the feeling word to be ornate or opulent, or you might want it to feel old world, right? And then your style word might be mid-century modern. So that will allow you to bring in these traditional touches and incorporate these more sort of filigreed pieces with the simplistic mid-century modern framework. Now, you talked about your TV being too large for the room. And guys, there's a simple way that you can measure to ensure that that's an accurate statement for your room. You take the measurement from the front of the screen to where your eyeballs are on the sofa. Take that measurement in inches, divide it by two, and that's the size of your TV. So if from the front of the screen to where you're sitting on the couch is 100 inches, you divide it by two and you need a 50-inch TV. Now, as we know, TVs are measured on the diagonal. So you'll want the 50-inch diagonal TV, right? So I can't be sure that this is too big. What I can be sure of is that it's too high. So when you're sitting on the couch, you want the TV to be at eye level. So if you drew a line from your eyeballs all the way over to the wall, that would be the center of the TV. So this is like not the center of the TV unless I'm standing up, maybe even on my tiptoes. It looks really high, which is making it look quite imposing. Now it's underneath this traditional secretary desk, which is causing it to be so high. So this is definitely the wrong piece of furniture. And also, if I'm going to have a piece of furniture under the TV, not only do I like it to be lower so that my TV can be at eye level, I like it to be longer than the TV or as long as the TV so it doesn't look top heavy. Right now, the secretary desk is about two-thirds the length or maybe three-quarters the length of the TV. And so the TV is looking all the more big, all the more disproportionate because it's so much larger than the piece it's above. Those are a few tips. I am never going to be one to tell somebody to get rid of the TV, especially if you actually watch the TV. If you actually watch the TV and it makes this room more functional for you and you find that it's one of the big draws in the room, then you need to keep it. But you need to find a way to have it look less imposing by lowering it and putting it above a more appropriate piece of furniture and measuring that it is the right distance from the sofa. If it's not the right distance from the sofa, you can move that sofa back because I see that you have a plant stand behind the sofa. So you definitely have room to increase depth in the space without getting rid of this TV or swapping it out for something smaller. So Renee, I know that's a lot to take in. First things first, solidify this floor plan. Make sure that the sofa is the right distance, make sure that the pieces are in the right place. And then I think we need to really curate. And by curate, I mean get rid of some things that aren't aligning with the overall vision for the room. There's definitely some missteps here. There's definitely some places where I think it's a little bit cluttery, and that's detracting from any two-word phrase you might create. Now, you might remember from previous episodes, me talking about my new house. And my new house, I want to incorporate antiques and ornate things because that goes well with the architecture. The architecture from the Victorian era that has a lot of carvings and things like that. But I actually love mid-century modern. So how do I fuse the two? And how I have done it is my style word is mid-century modern because that's what I really want to focus on more. But my feeling word is fancy. And fancy allows me to play with the time period. They don't necessarily have to be traditional pieces. Anything that feels a little bit gilded, a little bit ornate, a little elevated, a little, even if it's playfully elevated, like really not expensive. I just bought this kind of silly, ornate, gold filigreed coffee table at an auction for $35. It's really not expensive, but it kind of elevates and plays with this idea of looks in front of a standard mid-century modern sofa. So layering these ideas really works, but I have to be quite specific on what fancy means to me. And you're going to have to be very specific on what this word that encapsulates these traditional pieces is to you. So if ornate doesn't light you up, keep digging for that perfect adjective so that you can make the space more cohesive and get rid of things that don't align with those two words. Guys, it has been so great talking to you. I feel like I've been talking about design all day between presenting to three groups of middle schoolers and now to you. I will tell you, it has given me a newfound, even though, I mean, I've always had a deep appreciation for teachers, but hello, 30 middle schoolers in three back-to-back classes. I was only teaching them for 20 minutes at a clip and I'm tired. I need a nap. All right, guys, until next week. Bye.
You've asked for it, and we have answered the call. For years, you've been saying, Betsy, you're talking about all these great design concepts, but we can't visualize them. You're describing the picture that the listener sent in of their problem, and we wish we could see that picture too. After all, a picture is worth 1,000 words, and I do my best to describe them, but there's nothing like seeing it for yourself. And that's why Affordable Interior Design, the podcast, now has a YouTube channel. Not only do we have a YouTube channel where you could see recordings and clips of these podcast episodes, we also have an Instagram, a Facebook, and so many other exciting things. You should check it out. Head over to affordableinteriordesign.com/links. Once again, affordableinteriordesign.com/links. Links. And when you go there, you will see links to our YouTube page, our Instagram page, our Facebook page, and more. Please check it out, follow, and subscribe so you can see everything I'm talking about. A big thank you to our amazing producer, Catherine Heller, to Eitan and the MBCR House Band, and to Affordable Interior Design, the sponsor of this podcast and the premier place to get an amazing look on a budget. Check out affordableinteriordesign.com. If you guys love the show, the very best way to support us is by spreading the word. Tell your friends or write us an awesome review on iTunes. So until next week, guys, thanks so much for joining us, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.